All right, as I continued reading through 1 Kings, I was rather surprised to find that we'd actually gone all the way up through, as far as the text went, through the beginning of the story about the Queen of Sheba. That's because as I went reading through that again, it turned out that everything sounded familiar. So I guess Mickey went through it rather quickly, jumping a few chapters at a time, because there was some detail in there. As I'm doing my daily Bible reading, I'm in Leviticus, and of course, there's just laborious detail on how to, you know, build the tabernacle and the outfits for the priests and all that sort of stuff. So, and of course, in 1 Kings here, just before we get to the Queen of Sheba, there's just all sorts of detail on the building of the temple and the things that went on and the gazillion sacrifices that were made and all that sort of stuff. So. that's where we were there. So I think that once we get back into the text today, we'll start with the Queen of Sheba, which is in, chapter 10, is it? 11? Yeah, 10. let's sort of finish up these questions here. Remember that we had talked about the fact that King Solomon became king in about 961. And did all these things that he built the temple, which took how long? 7 years, and then he built his own palace, which took apparently it was an additional 13, because it talks in the text about the fact that it took 20 years altogether. It picks up the story saying that after 20 years, I was like, okay. But we do see several mentions throughout the text that the time that the people were there in Israel at that time, it was a time of peace and prosperity, and everybody was just happy, you know. So, David. I'm not sure. I think God sort of gave direction on how he wanted his temple built to a certain extent. I'm not sure he gave all the measurements and everything, but Joey did. Oh, yeah. No, the dimensions are there. It says that it's like... Right. They're in the text. It's like 150 feet long by 75 feet wide by 45 feet high. Which was 75 feet long and 30 feet wide? Huh? It might have been, yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood. So, and I'm not sure whether or not we could say that Solomon gave more attention to his house, but he certainly put a lot of more building material into it, that's for sure. So I'm not sure whether this is an inclination of whether Solomon thought more of himself than he did of God, or what, you know, why this was the case. But it could be that, and I don't remember it specifically, as I think through the text, God didn't direct, I want the tabernacle or the temple to be this wide and this long and this high and this. It appears that they just built it, but I'm not sure. Bruce? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Kings build palaces. Carolyn? Yeah. That's certainly possible. We don't see the detail about what they did with the cedars of Lebanon and such alike as that. We do know that because of these activities and other activities of the people in that area, they have essentially denuded that Middle East area. They did not give the trees time to grow back. They just cut. And by the time they were done, they weren't no trees. As a matter of fact, over there today in Egypt and Israel, they don't build out of wood. They build out of concrete, period. Chris. Yes, he did. Yeah, it does to me too, and it makes me think that indeed God did tell somebody what the dimensions were supposed to be. He just didn't feel that it was necessary to relate them to us. So whomever, the temple, you know, Solomon and on down the line, they knew what was supposed to be done. Well, Solomon didn't obviously have any guidance as to how to build his house, so he just built it the way he wanted to, I guess. whoever asked the question, I don't remember anybody saying that anybody's found any remains of Solomon's palace. All we find is some remains of Solomon's temple, which is what's now referred to as the Western Wall or the Wailing Wall. Well, those were that was just a temple. I mean, when they destroyed it all. And so then anything you see up above that Western Wall or the Wailing Wall, that was part of Herod's temple. In other words, the temple Herod built because the temple that was much when they came back from Babylonian captivity. And so Herod then took it upon himself a number of years before the birth of Christ to rebuild the temple and the walls and things like that. And then all of the wall and architecture and stuff that you see that's actually on the top of the city now, so the parapets and the shooting things and all that sort of stuff, those were built by the not the Muslims, but though they might have been, but I don't think they were. What's the name of them? The big conquering involved in that particular period. I forget the name. It's going to be in the right in the thousands, right in there. Yeah, maybe I'll come up with it one of these days. But the what? What'd you say? Did you say the Aztecs? Probably the Mayans. Yeah, maybe I'll come up with it one of these days. I keep coming up with Babylonian, and keep thinking that it's that whatever kingdom it is, it starts with a B. But Byzantine, the Byzantine Empire. Now, were they Islamic? I don't know. I don't know anything about the Byzantine Empire. I want to say that they were more just Middle Eastern, sort of up to the north and east of where Israel is now, but I'm just not sure about that. But anyway, most of the handiwork you see around the old cities in Israel these days is Byzantine architecture. So whenever that was. Okay. all right. So they were, since Solomon started the temple in the fourth year of his reign, and it took 20 years to finish both the temple and his house, then he must have been in the 24th year of his reign by the time they finished, right? So, all right. How long did it take to build the temple? Spent 13 years building. What? Who marveled at the beauty of Solomon's kingdom and declared the half was not told me? That was Queen of Sheba. And I think we sort of looked at that the other day at the fact that the Queen of Sheba was from down in the northern African region, probably about where Oman is right now. So at the Persian Gulf? Yeah, on the Persian Gulf. And so let me get my beast to work here. So what we're normally used to seeing, of course, is Israel around here, and then, of course, the Sinai Peninsula here, and then Egypt here. And we think of that as being a pretty big area. But when we start backing out, we realize that this is just a little baby compared with the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, or whatever that's called. the Arabian Peninsula, I should say. And Oman and such like, as then Ethiopia also are down here. And it is supposed that the Queen of Sheba came from that area. So she had a long way to go. Whether they took boats up there or just took a wagon train the whole way, I mean, she did bring a lot of gifts and things for him. But the Israelites, excuse me, the Israelites did have a port on the southern side here in what today is known as Eilat. But this is the area here, right up where the Sinai Peninsula goes up toward Israel. There was a port there, and you note in some of the discussions we have about in chapters 8 and 9 about Solomon's relationship with the other people around there, that he took of Hiram's folks. Hiram lived where? Tyre. And he was a what? A Phoenician. And they were famous for ship sailors. They were sailors. And so he hired a bunch of his sailors to go down here and sort of set up an Israelite fleet down here in what today is called Eilat. I forget what the name of the town is in the Bible. And then went out, and that's where it says that they brought in all sorts of neat stuff. And one of the things, I think it says they brought in peacocks, you know, but others. They brought in gold and silver and rare stones and this and that and the other thing. So once again, he was doing a lot of work there. But the Queen of Sheba came a long way to come up and talk to Solomon, and had a fur piece to go. I would think it would be much easier for her to go by water. So, but there's no discussion of that. So, all right. So the Queen of Sheba came up and visited with Solomon. Then there's all sorts of rumors about, well, the Queen of Sheba and her relationship to Solomon and da-da-da and this and that and the other thing, and how they were lovers and she lived with him and all that sort of stuff. And you go, exactly. Anyway, you know, all of it, pure, unadulterated speculation. There's absolutely nothing in the Bible that says anything about that. Nothing that even implies that. So we just see someone that's interested. As far as we know, she might have been 115 years old. Of course, he wasn't any young spring chicken too much, I guess. But, 24 years after the beginning of his reign, well, I guess he was still in maybe his 50s, 40s, something like that. All right. Solomon had a lot of what? We talked about that. How many wives and concubines did Solomon have? A lot. Do what? 700 concubines. That's right. That was you came up with the number of weddings per year. It was some horrific number of weddings per year. For a month? So, yeah. 17 and a half weddings per month for 40 years. Yeah. Anyway. All right. What proved to be the final downfall of Solomon's kingdom and why? That's right. Let's see. What? Do what? Exactly. Yeah. Interestingly, and I think I want to say the book points this out, that Solomon starts off his reign by making an alliance with whom? Egypt. So, and what does he do? Marries the daughter of Pharaoh. Then later on here in the text, just before we get to the Queen of Sheba, he also makes an alliance with whom? I mean, it specifically states that he makes an alliance with. That was with Hiram, the king of Tyre. So other than just, you know, sending him money to hire his folks, now he's making some sort of alliance with him. And as has been mentioned, they were told not to make alliances with foreign kings. They certainly were told not to multiply what? Wives or horses or anything like that. You know, they weren't supposed to make themselves, you know, supposed to be separate. Exactly, right. And we see that really comes to a to a head when in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, when they come back from Babylonian captivity. We see that there's quite a bit that needs to be taken care of there. All right. Turns out that God spoke to Solomon three times throughout this text here. You know, there was the one time that he spoke to Solomon in Gibeah when he first started off. And what was that conversation about? I think that's the third one. So the first one that I'm thinking about when he went to Gibeah is Solomon went up there and prayed to God for wisdom, right? And God said, I'll give you wisdom. And he also said, I'll give you riches and honor and a long life if, right, if you'll follow my word. There's then another discussion that God has with him in between these two where he essentially tells him the same thing. If you stand by me and if the people stand by me, then everything will be fine. And if it doesn't, you guys are in big trouble. And then he has this final discussion here. It says 1 Kings 11:11. So past where I thought I was. And that's the one you're talking about, Carolyn. Oh, I put that up here to trick you. All right. So, you know, wherefore Jehovah said unto Solomon, forasmuch as this is done of thee, thou hast not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded thee, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee and will give it to thy servant. Notwithstanding, in thy days I will not do it for David thy father's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of thy son. Howbeit, I will not rend away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to thy son for David my servant's sake and for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen. Now, how many tribes were there in Israel at that time? 12. And how many went to the northern kingdom? 10. And that leaves how many? 2. And God said, I'll give you one. So where's the discrepancy here? The one that we're talking about is Benjamin. The one they were the ones that were decimated by their own people because of the what did they do? They ended up killing all the men of Benjamin back in the, I think it was. So there was a rape occurred, and then all of the men of Benjamin were just terrible people. So the rest of the people of Israel went and killed them all, and so in order to preserve Benjamin, they married the wives of the Benjamites. And so technically there was a tribe of Benjamin, but it was really part of Judah. And so it was considered to be part of that, though we do see throughout the Bible and in the New Testament we see discussions about Benjamites. Okay, so it didn't give up its heritage and such like as that. It still had a name, as it were, but it wasn't much of a tribe. And it certainly wasn't pure, though the tribes of Israel were not to be pure among themselves. I mean, just because you were from Judah didn't mean you had to marry a woman from Judah. Randy? Yeah, he was. That's right. Yeah. Saul, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, right? I'm just making that up, but that's probably what it is, I think. It sounds very familiar. Saul the king, yeah. Saul, who became Paul, was a Israelite. That's Saul of Tarsus. Was the other Saul of Benjamin also? I don't know. It's another. Benjaminites. It's back yonder. I think it was at the time of the judges. Okay, so everyone named Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin. At least everyone that we know about. All both of them. Let me see if I can find, just by looking at the headings, if I can find the destruction. 20? Is it that far? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my header says Benjamin defeated and ravaged in chapter 20 of Judges. And then, okay. And then in 20 and 21, they talk about wives for the, 21, they talk about wives for the Benjamites. So, shameful abuse of a Levite's concubine, is that it? Is that what we're looking at? They capture, they take Micah's priests and images. Oh, yeah. Bethlehem, Judah. It's interesting to note that it's, okay, yeah, Bethlehem, Judah. So that's Bethlehem of Judah. There's another Bethlehem somewhere else. Okay, so now we know. So it's an interesting area to read, just to make sure that you remember that the tribes weren't exactly complete by the time things went around. The Benjamites, as it were a sort of a ragtag bunch and sort of aligned or associated very heavily with the tribe of Judah by the time that we're talking about Solomon here. final downfall was the wives, and then God appeared to Solomon one last time and told him what, and we looked there at 1 Kings 11:13, which is that as was mentioned, that the kingdom would be rent away. Is that the article that's in today's paper, bulletin? Rend the kingdom from Solomon. And is that right? Okay. I just put together the bulletin. I don't remember what's in it. So, yeah, it was Rend the Kingdom from Solomon is the title of the article. And that's exactly what would happen as God told him here. Give it to his servant because he didn't keep the covenant. And then he tore his garment into 12 pieces. And whoops, there's the answer right there. He tore his garment into 12 pieces, gave 10 of the pieces to one of Solomon's overseers named Jeroboam. Ahijah, yeah. And then the final question was, Jeroboam was promised that he would rule over what? Ten tribes. All right? So, Jeroboam, one that starts with a J, doesn't belong to Jerusalem. He belongs to the other place. So, whereas Rehoboam belongs in Jerusalem. So, I just have to, yeah, the J's don't go together. it's the only way I can remember them. All right. So, there was, once again, sort of a coup going on here. And Jeroboam was promised the 10 tribes that didn't follow after Solomon. All right, I think that's all the questions we had on that sheet, right? All right, so we'll we will at some time, perhaps before Mickey gets back, review the United Kingdom. But one thing that I wanted to discuss is that once again, here is a term that you see quite frequently, United Kingdom. And we see another term used quite frequently, Divided Kingdom. Neither of those terms will you find in the Bible. They're just used as convenience sake for us to understand that when we talk about the United Kingdom, we're talking about all Israel being under one king during this time. And so that entailed the reigns of who? All right, Saul, David, and Solomon. And then after that, after the time that we're actually beginning to talk about right now, is when the kingdoms become divided and they go off into the 10 tribes of the north and the 2 tribes of the south, and they are divided into what's referred to as Israel and Judah. And those are the times referred to as the divided kingdom. And they were ruled over by what kings? Name them all. About 4,000 kings on both sides, you know, for quite a while, up until when do we essentially lose track of the kingdom of Israel? Just what event? Assyrian captivity, right. And then, yes, Joey. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Now we see, as we look at these three kings of the United Kingdom, we see that they were generally spoken of as good kings, though Saul went by the wayside pretty quickly. David was not too bad, but he went by the wayside eventually. And then Solomon was sort of right in the middle there. But they're all referred to in certain instances with a certain amount of goodness to them. Now, how many, when we get to the divided kingdom and we go to the northern kingdom of Israel, how many of them were referred to by God as good kings? Zero. No, zero. None of them. And even if we look at the kings of Judah in the divided kingdom, we'll only find about a handful of them that were referred to as good kings. Who was the one that we've just studied about recently? Huh? Oh, we can come up with all sorts. Hezekiah is the one that I'm thinking of. Mickey Peach preached a couple of lessons about Hezekiah lately. And who was he the son of? That's right. Manasseh, who was referred to, what? David. Yeah, down the line. Was referred to as the worst king. And as a matter of fact, the reason that the people got taken away into Babylonian captivity is because of what Manasseh did. That's what God says. He says, because of you, it's all gone. He says to Hezekiah, I won't do it in your time. But after him, that was it. There were only a few kings left, and they only reigned for short periods of time. One of them was set up as just an appointee by the king of Babylon. Randy. The king list? Yeah, that's right. Right. Yeah, we had referred to that once before, and I keep forgetting about it. But yeah, it's a timeline that goes from Rehoboam all the way to the end. So, okay, and it also shows the prophets that are associated with them, which is a good thing too. That way, we know that when we're reading about certain prophets, that we can say, "Oh yeah, he was during the reign of Jehoram or something like where Elijah, for example, was there." It gives us a better understanding of what's going on. All right. I was going to go into the book here a little bit. In the middle of page 94 in your book, this is where they make the note. So the exact location of Sheba is unknown. Some legends say it was Ethiopia. Others say somewhere in southern Arabia. Perhaps further research will answer the question definitely. I looked online. Some people mentioned, as I say, Oman. Anyway, it's down there in what we refer to as northern Africa. But then, you know, Egypt is in northern Africa. Libya is in northern Africa. So when we think about that, as we go all the way down there to that big peninsula that comes out, or the Arabian Peninsula, you know, all of that, this still is still northern Africa, because Africa is a pretty good-sized continent. So when we look at it, we realize that maybe we're getting down into what you might call mid-Africa by the time we get down here to Oman, but there's still a lot of territory left. So once again, we think it's just from this general area that the Queen of Sheba came, and she came because she had heard about, which is interesting. You know, they don't have the type of communications that we have today, yet way down there, many many miles away, the Queen of Sheba had heard of the fame of Solomon and wondered if any of that was true, and took it upon herself to go up there and find out. And that was a trip of probably many months, I would assume. So she had quite an interest in finding out what was going on. All right. I like their comment here in the next paragraph after that, talking about the location of Sheba. It seems Solomon sought to amass women the way he did gold. And it would certainly appear that was the case. As it says, some of his marriages were for political reasons, so we look at the daughter of Pharaoh. But the text states that he loved many strange women. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're weird women. It just means that they're women that are not from Israel. Okay, there may have been some weird women, but still, you know, it was a person that was not from Israel. As we get to the end of his reign, and we look, where are we at? We look at chapters 10 and 11. It's 11 that talks about the many foreign women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, of the nations concerning which Jehovah said unto the children of Israel, ye shall not go among them, neither shall they come among you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. So, it seems like he was a pretty emotional person, I guess. But we also notice that as we look back in the text, and I didn't write this down, but it one of the places it says that it talks about the many proverbs that Solomon wrote and the songs that he wrote. It talks about the fact that he built gardens and things like that. So Solomon was a sort of a wealthy man about town type thing. He just did a lot of things for, as it were, for his own enjoyment. And I think perhaps by the end of his life, perhaps that's why he ended up writing the book of Ecclesiastes, because he realized that all of his seeking after wealth and the things of this world were not the important things that he should have been seeking for. And perhaps he was attempting to make a recompense for the life that he had lived up until that time, but by the time that he dies, we see that he's just in a really bad spiritual situation. Yeah, Joey. Yeah. Right. And interestingly, the text says that Solomon was wise above all those that were before him and all those that were after him. Yet we see, just because he's wise doesn't mean that He's going to hold to his wisdom. Yeah. I mean, I may say that this is the right thing to do and commit it myself. I mean, we look in the New Testament. I'm trying to remember now. It's on the right-hand page and left-hand column, about two-thirds of the way down. Talks about, it's going to be in Romans. Talks about you say and do not. And, in Romans chapter 2, wherefore thou art without excuse, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest. For wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself, for thou that judgest dost practice the same things. And so we can see that in this, here in Romans, the second chapter, we're talking about, you know, people doing evil judgment. But the fact of the matter is that a person may be saying that this is the right thing to do, honestly saying that, and then doing the same thing himself. God doesn't hold a whole lot of good thoughts for him right here in Romans, the second chapter. Randy? They were flawed. Right. Okay. Yes. Okay. Yes. No. Right. God gave Solomon the words to write. Okay, and throughout his time, God has used flawed man to reveal his word, his perfect word, to men, so that we know what we're supposed to do. Obviously, that's the only way to do things, unless we expect God to stand up there and talk to us all the time, you know, like the thunder that we saw on the mountain and the voice that they heard up on the Mount of Transfiguration, etc. But God doesn't do that. He speaks through his mouthpieces, which we call prophets. Yeah. Joey, do you have a comment?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Rick, could you knock on the kid's door and tell him I got 4 minutes left? Thank you. there's the nature of sin is just that way. I mean, sin is so tempting. I guess that's what it is. I mean, and the interesting thing to note is that the scriptures in the New Testament say that Jesus was tempted in all points such as we are, yet was without sin. And so he was able to see this and use the resources that we all have to do away with temptation or to not fall to it. So what resources do we have? We have our communication with God in prayer. We have our communication with God through the scriptures, through the word. We have all these things that we can do, the same things that Jesus had. He used them and took them to himself to make himself the sinless person that he was. And so that's one of the reasons why we need to look at the example of Jesus and do our best to emulate him so that we can, live the way that he lived. Do our best to become sinless. But obviously we'll not be, because God shows that there was only one person that was sinless, and that was Jesus. Bruce. Hebrews 1, yeah. I like the last phrase there that you didn't read, but he hath inherited a more excellent name than they. And we have a tendency to look at things like the angels and say, well, whoop, my thing's going in wait mode. Look at the angels and say, wow, you know, they're really a good example to follow. Of course, they're not examples to follow at all. But the fact of the matter is that it says here that he has inherited a more excellent name than they. So that person, Jesus, he's the one that we're supposed to be following after, and the one that gave us the example, and we need to have, at least in our mind, if he can do it, I can do it. And we need to at least try. Too many times, I think, we have a tendency to give up and say, well, it's just too hard for me. I'm going to quit and give up on trying to overcome the temptation that happens to be upon us at the time. It looks like, to a certain extent, Solomon certainly did that. I mean, he was tempted by all sorts of things, and he obviously fell to a lot of them. And to a certain extent, he's given to us as an example of what not to do. As are many of the kings. There are many of the people in the Bible. So that's something we need to consider, is that we need to try for perfection and not give up because we think that we can't make it. As long as we try, we're doing what God wants us to do. Okay, someone knock on the back door and let the kids know that it's time to come out. And we'll take up with wherever it is that we were. We'll look at the review of the United Kingdom, I guess, next time.